Whenever you see some gray depicted, either someone's dressed as one or there's a t-shirt or, you know, like the big inflatable dolls or whatever, they're always green.
Yeah, they're always
green. They're never, ever, ever gray.
Well, it pops.
It does pop.
You know, it's a nice color. Catches your attention better. That's,
I don't know if you know that Pedro does the fashion commentary for In Research Of.
I'm their fashion consultant for Leonard Nimoy's outfits.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so you may have some insights today with Giorgio's outfits.
Oh boy, howdy.
Since the dawn of 2009, one TV show has dared to ask the most important questions about the origins of our world. That show is Ancient Aliens.
Yet until now, no one has asked the biggest question of all. Is Ancient Aliens total bullshit?
And that's what our show's about. Finding the truth under the nonsense of one of television's most popular franchises.
This is...
more like Ancient Aliens.
This is More Like Ancient Aliens, a podcast about the hit pseudo-history channel show, Ancient Aliens. I'm Toby Ball, host of the international hit podcast, More Like Ancient Aliens.
And I'm Brandon R. Reynolds, a journalist who's only ever been able to get one animal at a time to do something with a ramp.
Oh.
That's Noah's Ark, you see, Noah's Ark.
I got it, yeah.
2x2.
If you just got 1x1, wouldn't have been as successful, yeah, probably.
It's the dinosaurs, that's what happened to them.
Yep. We are joined today by Pedro Mendez, a narrative audio storytelling specialist, podcasting and radio documentarian, published author, musician, and toy photographer. Brandon will get to the bottom of all of these things later in the episode. Welcome, Pedro.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on. But yes, we have a lot of nonsense to get through.
Yes, there's a lot. We got a lot going on in this episode.
But I do want to thank you guys for something. I have a degree in East Asian studies with a minor in religious studies. This is the very first time in my entire life I am putting it to use.
Nice.
So thank you.
We were counting on that.
Yeah.
All right. Today we are looking at season 16, episode 5, The Forbidden Bible. It originally aired on December 18th, 2020, which makes it kind of an Ancient Aliens Christmas special. On this date, we were in the middle of the pandemic. Vaccines had just been approved for emergency use, and top U.S. government officials said they would get it when the time was right. And not a whole hell of a lot else was going on.
It's like the Forbidden Bible itself.
That's exactly right. So why are we covering this episode? I would say that there's no bigger proponent of the Book of Enoch than Ancient Aliens. So here we really get down to the brass tacks with the Book of Enoch. So obviously that's why we're doing it. The thesis is the Book of Enoch is actually a story about ET contact. And because of that, the powers that be in the early Christian church kept it out of the Bible, except in Ethiopia. Also, some of it might be in the Great Pyramid. Who knows?
The Book of Enoch is kind of one of the other guest hosts of Ancient Aliens. It shows up a lot in the series, often with regard to angels, but also just like, you know, maybe the Bible that you know isn't telling us everything. So now we're just going to drill down on the whole thing.
Well, as a piece of basically batshit crazy fan fiction, it's perfect for them.
Yes. Yeah. The other nice thing about the Book of Enoch is when you see that they're going to be talking about it, that means you're going to get a lot of Eric Von Daniken. Mm-hmm. And you can never go wrong with him. Where do we start off? We start off in the Tigray Highlands in Ethiopia. The Garima Gospels date back to the 6th century AD. Jonathan Young shows up. He says that Ethiopia has roots in early Christianity going back 3,000 years. In 330 AD, King Izana converted to Christianity. And since then, sort of what they call a Judaicized version of Christianity has existed in Ethiopia for a while. Ethiopia became part of the Orthodox universe of churches. There's a tradition of monasticism and preservation of texts and religious practices in Ethiopia. And at one point, people thought that maybe the Ark of the Covenant was in a church or monastery in Ethiopia. Pedro, you're nodding your head. Do you have any inside info on this?
Well, on the true Ark of the Covenant? Yeah, I'll tell you guys offline later. No, this is, as you guys both know very well, and Toby, you know very well from Strange Arrivals, as soon as you have like an iota of mystery, that is a massive doorway for a whole bunch of stuff to get put into it, right? Seeds to be planted, books to be written, especially if you don't bother doing any research, and folks who work on the show don't, it's so much more fun to just take that little opening and be like, let's just, which is what the Book of Enoch is. Let's take that little tour and create a whole bunch of stuff around it when there's really nothing there. First of all, the claim that it's like one of the oldest Bibles on earth. Well, no, it's like an early illuminated version of the Christian books, right? Because they don't seem like, they keep going back and forth on like, when they say the word Bible, I'm like, do you mean the Hebrew Bible? Do you mean the Old Testament in the Christian Bible? Do you mean, you know what I mean? Like they really, and I will admit, I was a novice to this. So in the first few minutes of watching the show, I'm like, I can't believe they're getting all these things wrong. And as it went on, I was like,
I don't know.
Oh, I'm in the wrong place.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't start counting up things that are wrong.
It's sort of like when you're a child, right? And your parents are like, you need to go eat dirt so that you develop a robust immune system. You just haven't eaten the dirt yet.
Oh, I feel it now after an entire episode.
Yeah, you get a full mouthful right out of the gate.
I don't know how you guys can do it though, week after week.
Get used to the taste.
We've built up strong defenses. The story of Solomon is visited by the Queen of Sheba. They have a kid who the queen raises. He eventually wants to meet his dad, that being Solomon, goes and visits Solomon in the Middle East. When he returns to Ethiopia, he brings along some Jewish followers, and there remains a Jewish community in Ethiopia today. We spend a hell of a lot of time actually on this, and it's basically just to say that the Ethiopian Orthodox Church's Bible contains the Book of Enoch.
This is what's crazy too, because none of that is true, right?
Oh.
That the story of the Queen of Sheba having a child or whatever, it's one of the kind of legends and kind of elaborations that's happened, especially in Ethiopia, which helps connect them to the church, right? And it was told long after these things happened. But it's just told with such authority. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. They tell it with such authority that you're just like, no.
Confidence. It's a confidence thing.
Welcome to Ancient Aliens. We do get to see Lionel Fanthorpe, who mostly notable because of his awesome name. And he only shows up just to explain what language the Book of Enoch was written in. And then we move right along.
And he's wrong.
And he's wrong about that too?
Because he says about, you know, it being written in this Ethiopian language, Ethiopic or Giz. Their copy of it, written in the 15th or 16th century, which was a retelling, a recopying, a sort of a codification of the entire thing. It was originally written in Aramaic, parts of it maybe in Hebrew as well, translated to Greek. It wasn't a book. It was a whole bunch of different texts. And over thousands of years, it evolved, it changed, as stories do. And by the time the Ethiopians did it, do you know what I mean? Like, that's only like 500-600 years ago. That's not very long ago that they wrote their version.
Reboots in there.
So next you're probably going to tell me that Enoch was not Noah's great-grandfather, and it's also possible that he never died.
No, that stuff's all true. No, that stuff's...
because of one strange sentence they find in the Bible that I couldn't make heads or tails of. All right, our first Eric von Daniken sighting. He tells us that at the age of 12, two angels took Enoch to the, in quotes,
went up to so-called heaven.
So-called heavens.
Yeah, now he's skeptical.
Yeah.
This is a guy... It's got credulity tattooed on his upper lip, but this is like, he's like, I don't know about these heavens, man.
Yeah.
Where are the guardians when you need them?
The guardians.
Yeah.
Strangely enough, Enoch had no word for spaceship. So he describes houses of crystal, but he does see the earth below him and walks through a series of rooms with jewels and blinking lights. And apparently his is one of the first abduction accounts. Again, this is a quote. Written
by a fellow human being.
By a fellow human being.
You know, he also didn't have a word for slow cookers
or
SUVs.
But he was a fellow human being, which is nice to know. Michael Carter, who wrote Alien Scriptures, apparently is a book, said that Enoch strongly implies ET existence, and therefore the people who were like figuring out what it should and shouldn't be in the Bible had to keep it out because of the inferred aliens.
Yeah, I guess I'm sort of saying this now for the first time. We're always looking for the connections between the whole religious thread of things and the conspiracy thread, you know, and how that all fits together, right? How do you fit aliens and religious stuff together? And they have the same narrative for the Bible, particularly through Enoch and like that sort of thing, as they do with the government, right? It's like, well, somebody's holding out on you for some reason. They're concealing this information for some reason. It's the exact same narrative. It's like, well, the CIA is just hiding all these files from you because they don't want you to know, you know, for whatever reason. They don't want the populace to freak out or whatever. Or in the case of the Bible, we don't want people to know because they're going to flip over their ox carts and go running for the hills or whatever it is. But it's that same idea that there's a reason they're keeping this from us, even though the stories are about angels, demons, beings with swords, this heavens opening up. Like, the aliens are not the weirdest part of the Bible by any stretch of the imagination.
And also, just to be clear, the Book of Enoch and so much other Apocrypha, whether it's the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of James, brother of Jesus, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, these are not hidden. These are not removed because it's like they contain truths that nobody must know. It's always the same story. It's a consolidation of power and consistency. Like when the Christian church started to form, there were some books kind of work together, although they still really contradict each other. The four canonical gospels are full of contradictions. But then there was a bunch of other stuff that was like, that just sort of either goes against the things that we're talking about, or, you know, it doesn't support the view of Christianity that the first people who put it together were trying to propagate. And so they were just like, no, we're not going to include them. Also, they did kind of say, you know what, this is just a little bit too far off. Like the Book of Enoch, written probably around 450 BCE, well into the time since the many of the other Hebrew texts had been written. It was clearly, like, some scholars have actually called it like fan fiction or a spinoff. Yeah. And so when the rabbinic tradition was getting together to be like, let's put all of our writings together into something that makes sense, they looked at the Book of Enoch and they were like, no, this doesn't jive with everything else that we are thinking about what our religion really is. And they didn't, again, yeah, they didn't hide it. They were just like, no, it's okay. They just put it over there. Other people used it. It was still popular, but it wasn't, you know, collected.
I think that idea of fanfic is so, obviously it resonates so much because we think about, you know, Star Wars having canon, Marvel having canon, like these stories that come along and, you know, these franchises, they reboot and new writers come in and whatever. And so it's very easy to imagine a one-to-one. Like there was just some other guy who was like, hey, I heard this story. Here's my version. I mean, is there any sense of like what that was like? Like, why were these people writing these stories? Was it just how it evolved ear to ear?
It literally was retcon, because in this case, you know, the early books of Judaism written probably, you know, 700 to 900 BCE. And the whole story of the flood was kind of disturbing because it was like, why would God do that? Seems like an overreaction. Like even at the time, that seems like an overreaction. And into the 400s BCE, there was a movement in the Jewish community, messianic, apocalyptic. People were thinking about these things. And so somebody was like, it's like the same thing of like somebody's watching Star Wars and they're like, a bunch of rebels stole the plans. I wonder what that was like, because now we're all obsessed with those rebels who stole the plans. Let's tell that story.
Yep.
And so literally, and again, not someone, but, you know, probably a group of people over a period of time wrote these stories about Enoch, because it was, again, it was an open slate. It was a blank canvas. So you could just put whatever you wanted onto it, especially the concept of the Messiah, which really started to take form. This is why so many Christian churches really liked the Book of Enoch at first, because a lot of those ideas led directly to Christian thought. And so it was like pretty much everything in the Bible. It is a reflection of what people were thinking about and concerned with at the time.
And some of that got more influential than others. And then the organized church was like, no, this is not going to work for us.
But one of the best lines in the episode is that the Book of Enoch is an eyewitness account of what was happening.
Yeah. Again, welcome to Ancient Aliens. A lot of shit was eyewitness accounts.
Do you guys think any of them take this seriously?
Oh, I think about this a lot. Yeah, yes. Yeah, I think some of them, like, you know, we interviewed Jonathan Young. This is a legitimate scholar. And, you know, as any of those legitimate scholars will tell you, they get invited on to offer their insight. And, you know, a little chunk of that is excerpted from what they know, and then that's added in. So you have a couple of strata of participants. There's, you know, legitimate experts in science, history, culture, whatever, who come on and they say stuff, and that sort of mortars the story together. And then you have the ones who are the repeat customers, who now I think their entire bank account depends on it. And so I think some of them, you know, I was just reading about Wilcock, and Toby and I were going back and forth on him. I was thinking that he was just like, you know, kind of a gentle, like, this is a kind of a guy I am. But, you know, he's involved in this whole larger thing with this guy, Corey Good, and their whole falling out. And Wilcock thinks that he was the inspiration for the latest Matrix movie. So, yeah, I mean, I think they end up believing their own stuff.
Right.
But also, like, there's no reason for them not to, because then they're just, that's just like they're cutting off their,
yeah,
their supply line for food and prestige and whatever.
Yeah.
Now, I think, interestingly, the more that we spend time with this, I think Tsoukalos is really just a gentle type who, I mean, I think he's sort of innocent. I kind of think that he believes this. I don't think it's as nefarious as, I mean, I think he's wrong mostly or entirely, but I think his enthusiasm is legitimate. I think he's maybe kind of just a good kid who stumbled into something and is just running with it. I don't know. Toby, you think Toby's much more cynical than I am. So maybe Toby thinks he's.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I do think Tsoukalos isn't as objectionable, I guess, as so many of these people are, I think, in that I think he.
Objectionable is a good word. Yeah.
He's just sort of full of wonder, it seems like, even if like what he's wondering about is like completely batshit. I mean, I think there's a lot of people who are like on the grift. Like this guy, Michael Carter, for instance, who wrote Alien Scriptures. When was that written? Was that written after Ancient Aliens started? Like, I'm sure there's a cottage industry of people who are like, if I can get my little take on something that happened, I'll get on Ancient Aliens, I'll sell a bunch of books. And so I assume that's happened with a lot of these people, although I haven't done the research to prove it. I don't know. Like, guys like Childress, he seems like he's like a guy who can talk about just about anything in a credulous way. I don't know what to make of him, but Wilcock, like that dude will literally just say anything. They talk about the Old Testament and the Book of Daniel, angels controlling humanity's destiny. Enoch calls them the watchers of the sky. Eric von Däniken calls them ETs. Then we get this Rabbi Ariel Bar Tzadok, who said that the Book of Enoch was too hot to handle.
And therefore it fell along by the wayside, concealed and hidden.
Which is a brilliant counterpoint to everything that you were just talking about. Then there's some shit about Elijah, who also went to heaven on a chariot of fire. But he apparently had a power cloak.
Oh, yes.
That allowed him to heal the sick and raise the dead, which sounds 100% awesome.
So Harry Potter.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I had never heard of this.
And apparently looks like the space shuttle.
It does.
Going up.
It's like,
okay, that makes sense. That's that idea, again, where they do the side-by-side on screen. And they're like, who is it that says it? Oh, it's good old Zadok. He says, you know, this thing rises on something of fire, and then it goes to the space shuttle going up on a plume of fire. And that's sort of the same thing that happens when they're literally interpreting, you know, cave paintings on walls or any of that stuff. And it reminds me, I was just thinking about that. It reminds me of many years ago, I was a teacher at a Spanish camp in Minnesota. This was a summer camp for kids. It was an immersion camp. Now, I was not fluent in Spanish, but I was workable in Spanish. And I found that your mastery of the language, when you first learn it, it tends to be like big, strong words and verbs. So I was just walking around like a drunk Irish poet, you know, it's like everything is like, you know, when I'm tired, it's like the life has gone out of me. Or, you know, if I'm excited, it's like, you know, the fire within has come up big or something, you know. And so I would just go around talking to everybody that way, like trying to string together, you know, the like 50 or 60 words I had, which was all the basic nouns. And everybody thought I was extremely profound. They're like, that guy's, because he has these long pauses. He thinks very deeply. And then the stuff he says is just so crazy. It's like he doesn't even know the word for sandwich. You know, he's talking about like the flesh of the world between the wheat of the world, you know. It's like, yeah, that's what I knew. took forever for everyone to realize that I was totally full of shit. But that's what this seems like. It's like, I don't know, they were talking about these things in metaphors, and it's like, well, you can just describe that to anything. It seems super deep. It's just poetry written by idiots.
It was a power cloak. Let's not lose...
I think that's
the crux of the matter. Andrew Collins comes on, and he is identified as having written the book Denisovan Origins. And he'd been on before and credited with a different book. So I decided to do a quick little bit of research. And it turns out he's actually written 9 books. So I was trying to find out more about the Denisovan origins and like, why is he identified that way? This is the quick little synopsis of that book. The authors trace the migrations of the Denisovan giants throughout the world, their cultural and technological influences, and their interbreeding with Neanderthals in early human populations in Asia, Europe, Australia, and the Americas more than 40,000 years ago. They show that without this early hybridization, the modern world as we know it would not exist. So this guy knows what he's talking about. And I don't remember what he says after that. I was so distracted by his credentials.
I was distracted by the medallions.
Yes. The whole thing is a good piece. So we get in the Dead Sea Scrolls, we find out that Enoch not only wrote the Book of Enoch, he did a follow-up called the Book of Giants. And the Book of Giants talks about the Watchers who came to Earth and were getting women pregnant. And the kids become the Nephilim. And they are evil, and they slaughter and eat humans, which is not good. And then there's this whole thing about whether Noah was a genetically altered human being.
Thank God we got genetically altered human beings in there. It's been a while.
Yeah, he had radiant white skin and white hair, and he also had, quote, the ways of the Watchers, which is not further explained.
For me, I was legitimately being like, okay, so let's see where this argument goes. Let's see what direction they take and how they build on this and build on this. And then there were these just complete right turns and then just like spouting complete nonsense as if it is the absolute truth. Do you know what I mean? And then building on top of it. I was just like, you guys have talked about this too. It's relentless. Like, as you've said before too, I don't know if it's meant to be watched as one in one sitting, because like even the narrator, every line of the narration is delivered
strictly forbidden.
As if the ultimate secret,
shocking revelations,
is being revealed.
Profound truths.
Every line. Like, it's, imagine how exhausting it would be to be the narrator of this show.
Humanity's future.
He's a pro. Yeah, it is a little bit like when you see those con men who just like talk and talk and talk, and you're just like so like distracted that they're picking your pocket, and it's pretty good. I thought this might be a good time to stop. And Brandon, maybe you could talk to Pedro a little bit about his stuff.
Pedro, there's a lot to cover. But since you did say that this is the first time you're getting to use your education, your degree, tell us a little bit about that, how you got into this field of study.
Yes.
And why you let it go until now.
Yeah, no, totally. So I grew up, I was raised Roman Catholic. And until I was probably, 11, 12, I assumed I was going to become a priest one day, because I was really into it. I was an altar boy, then I became a lector and all these sorts of things. And then as a teenager, I actually saw the movie The Last Temptation of Christ. And that started to open a door in my mind. And then I started studying early Christianity. And I took it was like a pre-university course. And I remember the professor coming out and saying, well, if we look at the other gospels, and I was like, what? Oh, the other gospels. And he brings in this pile of gospels that are not in the canonical Bible. And he got us to read the Bible as historic text, not as religious text. And that was it for me. It was over, because I was like, oh, these are stories written by people at a time for each other and for what they're going through. That's all this is. But I still had so much woo-woo in me that instead I kind of went heavy into the, quote, Oriental stuff. And so getting into Buddhism, Taoism, I Ching, I was into tarot at the time. So it didn't completely exercise me of that stuff. I basically went, from one world of magic to another. And so when I went to university, I was like, well, I really should have gone to a monastery or something. Do you know what I mean? And really gotten into it. But my parents would have never paid for that. So they were paying for university. So I went to university and I took East Asian studies. And that came to an end. That line of belief came to an end when I met my, who is now my wife, and she said, yeah, that stuff's all really male-centric. And I was like, oh, damn it. She's right. And then it was just it started, the wall started to come down. Finally, like 2-3 years later, I went to Loch Ness after, you know, a lifetime of believing deeply in the Loch Ness monster. And somebody there told me, well, all the lochs have monsters in them. It's how they keep the kids from swimming by themselves. And I was like, oh my God, who's telling these stories? Why are they, you know what I mean? It all kind of came together. Religious belief, it's all paranormal belief, et cetera, et cetera. It all finally came together in my head and that was it. It was just, it was gone. And yeah, so that's why I've never really used the degree.
That's really interesting the way you described that, especially because you were so locked in on the Catholic course in life. And that moment that like you have this moment of revelation, but it kind of goes the other way. Like it does illuminate something, but it really like clears away a lot of, or like recontextualizes your understanding of the world. And you're like, oh, this is how this goes. But it could have just as easily been that professor came along and said that, or the one who said, you know, these are stories. And you do the thing that so many people do, which is you dig in your heels. You're like, no, this is the exact kind of resistance that I thought I was going to experience. And it actually, you know, strengthens your resolve toward that. Yeah. So it's so interesting how, you know, I always wonder, like, are people wired? And obviously there's a lot of research into that. But I wonder if you're wired that way and like something will clarify, or if it's the right place, right time.
Yeah, the right time, the right place in my life.
Yeah.
That I was open, you know, I was starting to open to this and open to that. And then finally, you know, the right thing was done. And Loch Ness, it was actually a very pivotal moment, because there I was on the shore, scared out of my mind, because it's a super creepy place. It was also the day that one of the people who faked the surgeon's photo admitted that it was fake.
Huh. Wow, good timing.
Yeah. And so it was like, oh. But it was, again, the feeling of being liberated from magical thinking. I have a greater sense of wonder in the world, because now, and you guys have talked about this with Ancient Aliens, the stuff that they talk in the peripheries is actually fascinating. Like the actual history of the church in Ethiopia, the actual history of Judaism and Christianity, it's actually amazing, because it's people doing amazing things that people do, right? And sure, telling stories, but like, oh, the way they do it.
We are the Book of Enoch to the Ancient Aliens Bible. That's basically it. They put our shit in clay jars and buried it in the desert, but it's out now, baby. It's out, and it's not going back in. So your podcaster,
yes,
as Toby said, what did you call him? A narrative audio storytelling specialist.
That's just my LinkedIn title to try to get jobs, although I have a very good job now.
That's good.
But I started working at CBC Radio about 25 years ago as a producer. I've now been working in podcasting as a showrunner and producer for about 10-12 years or something like this. Done a lot of documentaries for CBC and other places, written a couple books. So yeah.
Someone who works in public radio in America, I admire anybody who is not in America who has publicly funded public radio anymore. That's a recent change that we're all dealing with.
My condolences, guys.
Yeah. Now, on to the real thing that I want to talk about. Toy photography.
Oh, yes.
This is just some incredible stuff. It's called miniature photography, but it is toys and things. And it's just extraordinary. Just looking through these various and sundry things. You know what it reminds me of is this photography trick you may remember where they were filming real things, but it's a particular kind of like zoom and distance where everything looks tiny, but it's like real cars and people.
Yeah.
It lasted for like 5 or 6 years and then
tilt
people
shift.
Moved on from.
Tilt shift photography.
There it is. Tilt shift. Thank you for remembering that. Anyway, some of this reminds me of that, but then you kind of zero in on the details. How'd you get into this? I mean, it's just so great.
Thank you. No, I've been building models and dioramas and stuff for many years. Again, 25 years I've been building them. And I'd experimented with some photography, because when you build out these worlds and stuff, they look cool, but they're just in your house collecting dust or whatever. And so I tried taking a photo to see if I could kind of make it look a little bit real. I'd experimented with that for some years. And then a while ago on YouTube, I came across somebody. The toy photography movement has really exploded in the last couple of years. A lot of people doing it really, really well. And, you know, I just went all in. I turned my basement into a studio, started, you know, getting better camera equipment, lighting equipment, and And really, it feels like basically the me that I was when I was 10 years old, like watching G-Force, Battle of the Planets, building stuff out of Lego, and imagining these worlds, I'm now able to do it. I'm actually able to conceive of an idea. It started with toys. It started more sort of in the Godzilla vein. Then I started branching out and telling different stories. A recent one, I essentially put myself in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. So I'm on the highway, there's a light above me, the Devil's Tower sign, and I named it, actually, Strange Arrival, after Toby's show. And it's just turned into this unbelievable creative pleasure that I love. I love building the props, and I love taking the photos.
What are you making the figures out of?
The figures are, a lot of them are 3D resin printed. So, like, I got myself scanned, my wife was scanned, and other items and stuff like that get 3D printed. And then a lot of the buildings I make them myself out of polystyrene and insulation foam. It's really easy for carving.
Toby, you ever scanned your wife? Because that's a real mark of love.
Oh, yeah. Constantly.
Mm-hmm. Or do you shows? You ever done any? I mean, do you print them as big photos,
yes,
kind of a thing?
Yeah, I had an exhibit. I had my first exhibit at the beginning of the year, and I printed a couple photos, and they sold, which is amazing. So now I'm hoping to do an exhibit with more photos and actually some of the dioramas, so people can actually see these little worlds in person and then see how they photograph.
Oh, yeah. Do you keep the dioramas after?
No, because they're essentially props, so they all come apart so that I can reuse them and reconfigure them.
Man, Canadian life is so wild. You got public media, and you got basements that you can do dioramas in. I mean, that's incredible. He's got it all. All right. Thank you, Pedro.
All right.
I feel like we all know you a little better. That is, I think it's safe to say, very eclectic talent and knowledge base. And we're glad to have it here on More Like Ancient Phalanes.
Thank you. There is one photo, actually, that my wife called me out on. If you scroll down a little bit further, it's a shot of, it's like you're in some huge kind of a hall, maybe a cathedral. In the middle is an Egyptian obelisk on a plinth, and it's glowing red. The hieroglyphs are glowing red, and there's two astronauts looking at it. And my wife was like, that looks like some ancient alien bullshit going on there. And I was like,
well,
considering it's just a fun story, then I'm just telling a fun story.
You know where we're going now? Someplace in California.
Santa Barbara, California.
Santa Barbara, California.
Where Jonathan Young is headquartered. But he's not the focus of this.
I like the fact that he is headquartered somewhere. We're about to get another one of Pedro's specialties. Because Giorgio Tsoukalos and Ariel Bartzadek go to Santa Barbara. They take a field trip to talk to an imaging specialist. But that just pales in comparison because Tsoukalos is really dressed for the occasion. I would love to talk to Pedro for a minute about this, starting with the leather satchel.
The satchel.
He's carrying. Yeah, it's a nice piece of accessories.
Yeah, I mean, he's cosplaying as an explorer, right? So many of these guys do this. Graham Hancock does this too. The cosplaying. And the funny thing is, I've done this myself.
Shocking revelations.
Back in the day, I've worn the safari shirt and worn the bag. But the problem is, you realize all the stuff you would put in your bag, it's just in your phone.
Yeah.
You don't need the bag anymore. Like, you know what I mean? You don't need to bring all this stuff anymore. It doesn't make any sense. But he wants to look the part. And he's just, fascinating. Somebody needs to do a 6-part podcast series on this guy. And like, what is going on? And because the jackets, the suit jackets that he wears are awful. And he has enough money to like have proper clothes. But they look like leftover from the 90s. Like the shoulders are gigantic and the color doesn't flatter him. I'm just stunned, absolutely stunned. So this sort of explorer cosplay thing, I think it worked a little better for him. It's a little bit more in character, you know, to the type of, except that he's in like, what was it, Santa Monica or whatever?
Santa Barbara,
Santa Barbara. He's not in Egypt.
Yeah.
Seems like the great challenge of his sartorial career is Indiana Jones died in like the 60s. So how do you modernize that outfit? I mean, you know, you got the basics, you got the earth tones, obviously the satchel. Presumably there's a whip in there, which, Pedro, you cannot keep in your phone no matter how hard you try.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's like, how do we update that? Like, what does he look like? I don't know. I mean, I think he probably just still looks like Harrison Ford. Like Harrison Ford just dresses like Indiana Jones
and
grown up. But yeah, there's some interesting moves there. And then yeah, everybody, the giant talismanic necklace does seem like it's a kind of a mind virus that is spread among the ancient aliens luminaries.
A question for you guys, because the narrator keeps saying ancient alien, is it theorists?
Ancient astronaut theorists.
Astronaut.
Yeah. Ancient astronaut, that's interesting. Ancient astronaut theorists. And he never says who the hell those people are. And I'm thinking to myself, are they the ones with the amulets? Like which of the guests is he talking about? Because you guys have often talked about that on the show because that line is repeated so many times. But I was stunned to watch an episode and be like, wait a second. You never actually say who you're... Like, you could literally be saying whatever the hell you want because you never point to anybody.
It's true. Yeah, there's no chyron that says ancient astronaut theorist under anybody.
Right.
It's all like their publishing credentials or whatever. People who have ideas about stuff in space from a long time ago, you're an ancient astronaut theorist.
But it sounds like there's some like institute in Switzerland or something with like 50 of these people sitting there writing papers.
It's the invisible university, I think. I kind of think about it as the same thing when asked about Frederick Douglass and Donald Trump said, oh, a lot of people are saying he's doing a really good job. And it's like those people.
Yeah, it's the them. Mm-hmm. Now, why the show's not called Ancient Astronauts is another great mystery. Oh, but I did notice, I don't know if y'all noticed this, but I was somewhat distracted from when they're in this guy's photo lab, which is full of some kind of technology that's beyond my ken. But there's Sukulis and what's
the rabbi.
The rabbi.
Yeah.
They're standing side by side, and in the background, somehow in full focus against the wall, is a giant picture, probably, Pedro, about the size of something that you would print out for an art show, of a woman's chest.
Yep.
Now, she's got a shirt on, but it is very, very high definition. You know, cut from the neck down, she's in like a tank top, spaghetti strap tank top, and then these guys are having a serious conversation.
Yeah.
About hidden ancient scrolls that were destroyed or rolled up or whatever. Then
Did you look it up? What? This is just a photo lab.
Yeah.
Like, this place is just a photo lab. But you're right that the producers of the show didn't go in there and be like, could we just, like, take those down off the wall just while we're shooting? Because
make it less of a garage. Yeah. So, anyway, in the end, we get, was the flood story really about extraterrestrials interceding in the affairs of man? My answer is no, but ancient astronaut theorists say yes. All right, Uzun Gully, Turkey, 1997. A guy named David Allen Deal, about whom we find out almost nothing else, is searching for the Ark, not the Ark of the Covenant, Noah's Ark, near Mount Ararat, and finds a lost village, which Childress speculates is the first post-flood settlement. So, not having heard much about David Allen Deal, I decided to take 5 minutes and find out what his deal was. No pun intended. And it turns out he wrote a book called Discovery of Ancient America, The Ten Commandments Discovered in America Before Christ, which, again, amazing if true.
Nope, thoroughly debunked.
That sounds really Mormon.
In the quote about this book that is on the webpage says, his conclusions, considered highly controversial in some quarters, are nevertheless, if true, of tremendous importance.
Yeah.
He is thoroughly convinced that America, possibly as long ago as 3,500 years, was once occupied by Hebrew mariners who left their mark with an inscription of the Ten Commandments. I thought it was kind of ridiculous.
The ridicule that so many people on this show spout when they're talking about Egyptologists, archaeologists, other scientists, right?
Yeah.
And they'll say things like, oh, they think they know what they're talking about. They think they know everything. And I'm like, well, they have dedicated their lives to studying something using peer-reviewed evidence and repeatable testing. And you're listening to a guy who's just pulling this out of his ass. Like, literally has nothing else except that, you know what? Maybe this happened. But I think, as you guys have said before, if they just say it enough times and enough confidence that the audience, and it hurts me a little because I know that my mom used to watch the show and like really believe it.
Ooh.
And she's Catholic. Yet she really believed this because it's, you know what I mean? It's told with such authority and there's graphics.
Yeah.
I mean, like you said, the beginning of the episode, Pedro, is the power of mystery. You know, there's something just around the corner. There's something, you know, that is, I mean, it's just, it's something we're just hardwired to be like, I'm curious. I wanted to explore. And, you know, in modern times, everything feels like it's revealed, you know, almost like the ability of the internet in your phone to tell you anything you ever want to know sort of cheapens that. So like stuff that you can't find an easy answer for is kind of paradoxically that much more compelling. So I think, you know, you can be like, yeah, 99% of scientists think climate change is real, but this one guy thinks the world is flat, you know, or whatever.
Yeah. Right.
You're like, well, maybe there's something to that. And the more you don't find it, the more it's just out of reach. You know, it's fascinating. And that's why, again, like I was asking you about what's the thing that, you know, flipped the switch in your mind and you're like, oh, this is all just stories. I mean, it's, you know, there's something fundamental.
Like with the flood story, that once you start looking into it and seeing all the different sources that it was taken from, the Epic of Gilgamesh and other writings that evolved over time, it's fascinating. It's fascinating to see the way that story evolved and the different characters, how they showed up or didn't show up, the kinds of birds that Noah sent and which ones came directly from Gilgamesh or came from other stories. That stuff is fascinating. And again, if you look at it in terms of like, what were people going through? What were they experiencing at the time? But then to try to build this whole show will take a single line that is a misinterpretation of something that somebody said, didn't know what they were talking about in the first place. And they will build an entire like pyramid on top of it. It's a house of cards. I mean, it's so easy to knock it down. And yet, are they still going? Is this show still on the air?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Season 26, maybe?
Do any of them, do they tie together? Here's the other question I have for you guys, after seeing so many shows. Because when I look at this, I'm thinking to myself, okay, is there some big overarching theory that they're working with that it all connects to? Or does everything just, they just pull it out of their asses? You know what I mean? And if you actually strung them together, you'd be like, yeah, but in this episode, you said Noah this. And in this episode, you said Noah that. Does that happen?
I mean, it's a little bit like the X-Files in that there's, I think there are different kinds of episodes. Like there's sort of like the Monster of the Week episode. And then there's like sort of the canon episodes. And I think the real canon episodes are that aliens have manipulated human genes to create what we are now, and have also directed most big advancements. So I think there's like this sort of general sense that we are who we are now biologically and technologically and intellectually because of alien intercession. And I think that's kind of like the through line through a lot of this stuff, but not every single episode is like trying to advance that particular case. So like Aliens in the Civil War, for instance, has almost nothing to do with that. It's just like random weird shit that happened around the Civil War that, you know, ends up with them proposing that an alien posed as the ghost of George Washington to inspire the Union troops to win some Civil War battle. And that shows that the aliens were like for like universal human suffrage and the end of slavery and stuff.
Yeah, you know, you always have to operate from, you know, the dissatisfaction with the human race, which again could be from anything, right? Like the idea that, oh, it would be better if, I mean, on the religious side, it's if God was moving through us with angels, guardian angels, demons, whatever, like if there was some deeper and more fundamentally true reality that's guiding us, that's better than all the shit that's just around us, because this sucks and I'm dissatisfied.
Yep.
And so the extrapolation of that for this is that's how it's always been. And so like no great thing was ever created by humans. You know, you go on Reddit, and Reddit is, it's always a fever pitch of people who, surprisingly, I think, rag on Ancient Aliens. Like, there's a lot of people like, this is bullshit. And one of their takeaways is that it's essentially racist because it's like non-white people.
Oh, no. Eric Von Däniken was straight out racist.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Straight out.
Yeah. 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 But, you know, it's not just that. I mean, you know, they also think Einstein didn't do it, which you could say is anti-Semitic, but they also thought Wernher von Braun couldn't do it alone. So like, if the Nazis can't do it, then, you know, who's left? Who's left? So I think there's a general cynicism toward human accomplishment.
They have to fill, you know, I've worked in media for many, many years. You have to fill all these hours. Anything is your game for anything. So anything you can come across, you will fit it in there and you will say something about it. That seems to be their modus operandi.
Yeah. I don't feel like we've encountered as many batshit episodes like that. Like that we thought the Old West was going to be great. And it's like, that has nothing to do with anything other than apparently UFO pilots who sucked and kept crashing into windmills, you know?
You guys said this before too, where if this show and this kind of show wasn't destabilizing our society and our democracy with misinformation and with destroying people's ability to have critical thinking, if it wasn't for that, tons of fun. Like just as a, you know, thought experiment or whatever, tons of fun. But unfortunately, that's not what it is.
Yeah. And it's the same thing you see, you know, the attitude, the hand wave of like, we're just putting out ideas. It's like, that's the same shit that like Joe Rogan does.
Just asking questions.
I understand that. Absolutely. But at some point you have to recognize that you have a responsibility.
Yes.
Like there are people who are being influenced by the things you do. You know, the First Amendment covers a lot of territory in the United States. So legally you're protected. And I think that's the right thing. But on the other hand, I think you as a producer of content should at some point say, maybe I can't fuck around like I used to because
it has real consequences. Yeah.
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 I mean, I was talking to one of the writers for the X-Files and I kind of brought up the whole thing about conspiratorial thinking. He was like, oh, if, you know, if we contributed in any way to like the kind of thinking that brought around QAnon and some of these other, he's like, I would feel really, really bad about that. I think that's a step removed from this, which is encouraging you to look at reality as being a conspiracy rather than creating a fictional thing where a lot of the suspense comes from a conspiracy, but is, you know, it's clearly fiction. It's not like you're going to watch Starsky and Hutch and take your theory of the world from them. But I think, you know, I think people did with the X-Files think like, well, this is kind of the way it works.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
Two ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
No purchase necessary. See rules at playatmcd.com for full details and amoe.playatmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.
Anyway, I feel as though you guys are just talking, so you don't have to talk about the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis. And
damn it, Toby, the only reason I got up today was to talk about the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis.
They come up with these things that are interesting that almost nobody would know about in sort of their general knowledge. And then they're able to spin that into something that seems very alien-ish when there's like a different explanation. But anyway, they talk about this, you know, supposed cataclysm that happened around 10,800 BC, a halo of ash that's found around the earth at a certain strata all in all these different places. That is known as the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, and it suggests that a comet or asteroid impact or airburst event occurred around 10,800 BC and triggered widespread environmental devastation, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, there's a bunch of different aspects to it. It's not established. Like, there are people who doubt that it actually happened. And for some reason, they have this guy, Robert Schock from Boston University, who says it was caused by huge solar flares.
This caused, in a flash, the glaciers to melt virtually instantaneously. It caused evaporation of water.
Like, I can't even melt a freaking ice cube instantly, so I don't know how that's going to work.
Toby, you did seem legitimately defeated by the knowledge that you could.
He's been trying for so long. Why can't I?
Yeah, it's been a quest of mine for a while.
That's why you need one of those talismans that has like a lens in it so you can focus the sun's rays.
Yeah, that's right. So the question that we have to ponder is, were chapters of the Book of Enoch, or perhaps the Book of Giants, were they hidden in the Great Pyramid of Giza?
No.
And
let you look.
That's, you know, Pedro's very quick to say no. And as a matter of fact, mainstream archaeologists will tell you that the pyramid was built around 2500 BC. But Eric von Däniken thinks it was much earlier. Westerners don't know the history of pyramids written in the East, and that maybe they were built before the Great Flood. You know, we actually have a better idea of that. It was written about by historians. And there's been radiocarbon dating was done on parts of the pyramid that could be radiocarbon dated. And it all points to about 2500 BC, maybe mooting the point or the question, did Enoch build the Great Pyramid? Again, I'm sensing that you think that maybe it didn't happen that way. Tsoukalos says that some guy named Al-Makritzi said that pyramids were built to preserve knowledge given by so-called gods.
The so-called gods.
Which he then helpfully says is spelled with a small g.
They take you up to so-called heaven.
Yes, exactly. And then they ask if the blocks were levitated into place. Again, seems unlikely. I feel like the last 5 to 8 minutes of any Ancient Aliens episode is where they kind of run out of their like research and they're like, all right, let's just start talking about some shit.
Just fill time. Just like us.
So we get into this thing about Khufu and an interior room, but there are reasons to doubt that these hieroglyphics were really there. And I was like, well, haven't other people like gone up and like checked it out? Or was it just this one guy? And it turns out that actually at that time period, there weren't often weren't hieroglyphics in internal rooms of pyramids, whatever. They just discovered a 30-meter void, perhaps a room in the pyramid. This is actually true, yes. That there is this void. What may not be true is Eric von Däniken's belief that it's a time capsule, which seems like kind of a random idea. And then perhaps, to be more precise, more writings from Enoch that would prove that aliens actually visited Earth. So that might be there.
There might also be a slow cooker there.
There could be. Who's to know? But until you tell me that it's definitely not that.
Oh, I can tell you it's definitely
there's
not.
There's a chance that there is.
No, it was an architectural space. It was an architectural space to help the design of the building. That's it.
Yeah. And that's kind of where things end.
Whoa. You guys can't forget Lane Little. It's like if Baz Luhrmann had directed a Poirot, an Hercule Poirot episode.
Yeah.
He's amazing. Like you know, we've had guys with amulets. We've had guys with scarves. But he's got a wing collar. He's got a very bright blue tie and then the blue scarf over his vest. And he's got a little, you know, turned up Hercule Poirot mustache and the round glasses and earrings. Like, you guys probably don't know this, but Coco Chanel had a very famous line, which was, before you leave the house, look in the mirror and remove one thing, one accessory, one extra thing. This guy, he's like, no. Add five.
Yeah,
it's just fabulous. I don't know what he said, but he was just fabulous.
Yeah, he let his clothes do the talking. Any last thoughts about this episode that anybody wants to contribute?
I just want to say that what this actually brought to mind for me is the dangers of using Google, because when you type in some of the stuff from this episode into Google and it gives you the AI summary, that AI summary is drawing data from a lot of nonsense, right? And a lot of really poor sources. Usually the first sources you find in a Google search aren't that great either, but it will say things that back up what happens on this show because this show has said it and put it on the internet. And now Google just scrapes that. So that for me was super depressing to realize that if you want to dig into these things, you'll go to Google and it'll be like, oh yeah, it's true. I guess it's true. It's like, no, it's just scraping the books from these people who, you know, were interviewed on the show.
It's like the five scariest words in the English language are, I do my own research. Oof. Brandon, do you have anything you want to contribute before we sign off?
No, I'm just glad to be here.
Just glad to be here.
I'm glad that we had Pedro on.
Set us straight.
A real voice of reason and wisdom.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Pedro, thank you so much for being on. It was great having somebody who actually knew about some of this stuff to counteract the bullshit.
Well, great to finally, like I said, finally put the degree to use. Thanks, Dad.
There you go.
Watched you blow the dust off of it and it still shone like a gold thing buried in a pyramid a long time ago, pulled out of the void. Pedro, where can we find your stuff?
Yes, I think probably the easiest place on Instagram, it's pedro.mendez, M-E-N-D-E-S, .miniature. And I do have a website that is titan.myportfolio.com, where you can see my photos in high res.
Well, thank you, Pedro Mendez, for explaining to us why the Forbidden Bible was so forbidden. And now we know. Mostly nonsense. This has been More Like Ancient Phalians. I'm Brandon R. Reynolds.
I'm Toby Ball.
And we'll see you next time.
Next week on More Like Ancient Phalians, Brandon went all the way to Antarctica and didn't even see the technologically advanced under-ice Nazi cities. Probably grounds for a refund. We are talking about The Pyramids of Antarctica, Season 11, Episode 1. See you next time.
More Like Ancient Phalians is produced by Grab Bag Colab, and our editor and producer is Heather Eagle Ears Wilson. Our music is by Nathan Reedy.